today we're joined by Mary, who tells a story about her teenage years living with her family, which happens to have slightly different rules of the household than what most of us are used to. Her family is Jehovah's Witness. She goes through the typical teenage rebellion years, which most kids do, but in her case, it could be her fate or salvation. She makes a choice, and to most of us, it'll sound like the toughest choice of her life, but it was the best choice for her. So, where are you located at?
Brisbane.
Oh, okay, cool. I have to say that I was rather taken by your story that you wrote in with. I happen to have a few friends that are in very, very religious families and have been, I guess, what do you call, excommunicated? And usually it was just like a family that just kind of kicked them out or shunned them. But I never heard a story from anyone that's really been in a, you know, a whole group or community that way. So you can give a synopsis of how, I guess, how you were raised and brought into the church or the religion.
I don't know how much you know about Jehovah's Witnesses in general.
Very little.
Very little, yeah. Well, if you ask them, they would say that they're Christian. Though most Christianity believes in the Trinity of the Son, Holy Ghost, and Spirit being one. Jehovah's Witnesses believe that God and Jesus are two separate people. There's a Father in heaven, sent his Son to earth. And there's a big difference between all, because they believe in Jesus, they believe they're Christians. It does bring argument with those kind of religions, like the Mormons are the same, mm-hmm. and the Seventh-day Adventists have similar beliefs.
Okay.
Growing up in these religions, it's like God's always first. We believed in God, Jehovah, and even more so than, you know how a lot of religions, it's all about Jesus?
Yeah.
Well, with our religion, it's all about God and all praises to him first, before even Jesus.
Or family.
Well, in a sense, it's just that we have to give the glory to God before anybody.
Okay.
And God's first, his laws first, above country, above law. So they've basically taken the Bible, like all religions do, and spun it their way. I think it's difficult when the Old Testament is a guide to your life. You know, the Bible has stories of Abraham and all of those kinds of things, and they just seem so distant. So those are the kind of things that you live by, those parables in the Bible.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of religious people will understand this, is that whenever you come across a problem, those stories will like pop up into your head. And you wonder, oh, how will I deal in this situation? And that's how your brain works. And it's really strange.
Well, it's what you've been taught. It's what you know. It's what you practice every day. So it does make sense to me that, you know, I have a challenge in my life. So how am I going to approach this? Well, what would my Bible say? And then you go to whatever story it is. I get it.
Well, I think it isn't strange until you, because we all learnt to use our feelings, our, you know, emotions. How do you feel? Pray about it, you know, and see how you feel about that. There's kind of no logic involved. It's all about your feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine you're a teenager who's, you know, confused about life in general. And your feelings, your heart, is not generally the best guide. So it can be confusing, and you go through a whole lot of emotions of guilt. Your conscience plays a massive part in everything you do. And I just remember being angry. I was angry all the time. I don't remember a part in my childhood when I wasn't. I was angry at God. I felt like he was this anvil around my neck, mm-hmm. just holding me back from everything that I ever wanted to do, because they believe that Armageddon will come. So they're Armageddonists. The only people saved will be the Jehovah's Witnesses. Everyone else will be swept away in this cataclysm.
Did they have any date on Armageddon, or was it just
no.
whatever?
They used to, up into 75. Uh-huh. I think from the late 1800s, along with the Seventh-day Adventists, they were that group that used to pick out a date and say, it's coming, it's coming, coming. It never did. And then I think in 1975, they had a mass exodus when it didn't happen, and the whole structure changed. Growing up, it was more, we don't know. We don't know when it's going to happen, okay. but it will. It will. It was like this constant thing. And we don't believe we're going to heaven either. We believe we're here for the earth. Revelation is a big part of their religion, of course.
Okay.
They've taken 144,000 in the Bible of those, I think it's 144,000 virgin boys who translate to heaven in some way. I can't really remember. And they believe there's only 144,000 people who are going to heaven, and we call them the anointed ones. But they're kind of like anybody in our religion. I don't know how it works. I don't understand it, how they pick the people who are going to heaven. And they're the only one who takes sacrament as well. We don't celebrate birthdays. We don't sing the national anthem. We don't go to war. We're basically an island off the coast mm-hmm. of the mainland.
Okay.
And we only go to the mainland to preach and for supplies. I'd say that's pretty much how it is.
I guess the 140,000 whatever.
Yeah. It's basically, if you feel like you're going to heaven, you would tell somebody. I don't know exactly how it works. You get chosen, and you then are the only person who takes part in the sacrament at Passover time. Okay. And I've only ever seen it once. Uh-huh. One woman who was in our joint congregational Passover, where she took the sacrament, you know, the bread and the wine, and because she was going to heaven. And I don't know how that comes about and how they've decided that from the Bible, this 144,000 is different from our 144,000, but that's basically the belief.
I would just assume that there's already been 144,000 that have lived and died, and all the seats might already be taken, but maybe that's just my ignorance.
<a possibility>.
To, I don't know. I'm not trying to make fun. That would just seem like a logical question. Is there any more seats left?
That is a question, and I'm guessing there has to be. I never knew how many were left growing up. I only ever met one, and I can't tell you the doctrinal explanation because I never understood it. It just never made sense to me. And I guess that was the theme growing up. I had a lot of those things where things just didn't make sense to me, and I was angry that I was trapped. Mm-hmm. We were taught that, as I said, the Jehovah's Witnesses were the only ones going to be saved on earth, and that the worldly people would all, you know, be cast away. So we were supposed to have associations in the world, friends, and so on. Even though I did, you know, at school and everything, and I'd sometimes look at them and think, you know, this can't be. They're like good people. These people are good people. How can this be? How can God just want to destroy them? Mm-hmm. And I would think about Abraham and him wanting to bargain with God over the lives of the people in Sodom and Gomorrah. And I'd think, you know, would I do that? Would I bargain with God over my friends? It's this constant barrage of conscience and confusion. I was constantly confused and angry about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, in most other religions, if you're just a good person that believes in God, you get to go to heaven, whereas everybody else is going to hell. So at least there you got a 50-50 chance. But in this case, you're told not to be around other people, not to form relationships with them, and you're not even guaranteed you're set up for failure, really.
Well, I think that's exactly how I felt. I think women in our religion don't really have a place. There's a lot of religions who have women who have status. Jehovah's Witnesses, we just have elders and the women are supporting roles. So I remember, ever since I could remember, I said to my mum and dad, I'm never getting married. I'm not having children. I just thought that that's all there was. You know, I'm going to get married, have children, sitting in a sewing circle, swap recipes. Even though all that eventually happened, it's just as a child thinking that's your only option, not even education, because at the time, I can't say for now, but at the time it wasn't, no one said no, but because of Armageddon, you're not supposed to put your pursuits into worldly things, in secular work. Anything that can take you away from our religion is deemed
inappropriate.
You know, a worldly pursuit.
Yeah.
Just remember clearly, like my brother and I had this conversation where we thought that, spoke about how we just had no future. Our only future was basically Armageddon coming and us being the cleanup crew, I suppose.
That's so screwed up. I'm sorry. I just, I can't, you know, I tried to be professional when you were telling in the beginning, but it's screwed up that a child would have to believe that and be brought up thinking.
Oh, this, so we used to go to meetings 4 times a week along with field service. So it takes up a lot of your time because in between those days, you have to study for the next meeting, as well as your job and everything else, school that you've got going on. And if that job takes you away from those meetings or any of your outside pursuits, then someone's going to kind of mention it and ask, you know, why aren't you coming? What's been happening? You know, maybe that you should, you know, slow down on the work. Then if things start slowing down even more, you may even have a walk in and a mention with the elders.
You're persuaded, it's suggested, and then they go to a point where they could try to correct the action.
This isn't about making them look bad, about making my family look bad or any of them look bad.
No.
It's just a lot of people right now are in these kind of religions and are not knowing how to go about leaving. Especially as a teenager and you're still under your parents' roof. So I just want to make that clear that this isn't a religion bash. Because despite it all, I think my parents really did try. When I was very young, this actually happened, you know, quite a few times growing up. Whenever we'd have family problems, my parents would think that there was a devil's influence in our home. So they would do kind of like a spring cleaning to look for any publications, to get rid of any records that may have been. So I remember, you know, mid-80s they got rid of Sgt. Pepper's Beatles album,
mm-hmm,
because that was an influence. And Kiss also, that was another one. So they often did this and got rid of the TV, got rid of any undue influence whenever things were going wrong. I remember one time my dad found a Cosmopolitan magazine in my bedroom and, you know, was telling me how this was an influence from the devil and how we can't have these kinds of things in our home. And, yeah, it's confusing. It's really confusing for a child to see all this stuff and then not be afraid. I think I was constantly afraid and constantly angry because I was afraid. But as I said, you know, when you marry in our religion, it's usually quite young. You usually marry the first person you see or have a taking to, because dating's always chaperoned.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not even sure if you get to kiss before you marry, to be honest.
Yeah. It's almost
How
an
crazy
arranged,
is that?
It's like an arranged marriage at that point.
In a sense, you would have to want to do it, but I'm guessing the reason why you actually get married is so you can take that next step. If two people really like each other, you know, usually you can have that physical connection to see, oh, how do we go any further? Mm-hmm. But with our religion, you'd get to date chaperoned and maybe hold hands. And then if you wanted to go any further, you would have to get married, mm-hmm. I'd guess. Remember thinking that I didn't want that for my life. I didn't.
What was your biggest points of contention? Was it the arrangement of it all? I mean, how you were dating, how you couldn't go out and get a job or do things on your own? Was it just that confinement, like feeling constricted?
I was gifted athletically. That's how I felt growing up. I was really good at that kind of stuff. I had teachers tell my parents, oh, you know, you should be putting her here, you should be putting her there. And eventually they allowed me to join gymnastics, which was in our Olympic Centre now in Sydney. I did that, and I think my parents understood that there wasn't going to be maybe a great plan for me. And that's another thing. We never sat down and said, you know, oh, what do you want to do with your life? You know, where are we going to go from here? You're going to go to university? There was none of that. All I want to be was, as a child, was an Olympian. I want to be a gymnast. I want to go to the Olympics. And, you know, my parents kind of said, oh, you know, we'll let you go. I don't think they thought that it would ever go anywhere. And then as soon as it did, they yanked me right out because we're not allowed to do anything for our country. Mm-hmm. We're not allowed to go to war. We're not allowed to stand in front of a flag and do anything nationalistic.
Yeah.
So I devastated when I couldn't. I felt like my only talent was in athletics of some sort, and Olympics is a big part here in Australia.
Yeah.
So when I couldn't do that anymore, I felt like I had nothing else. And from that point, I was just angry. I didn't want anything to do with them. Started skipping school a lot and just pissing them off, I guess.
Well, what age did you start doing that?
Leaving school and being naughty.
Yeah.
I'd guess it started around age 15.
So you're rebelling, and
yeah,
I'm sure they're noticing.
I'm rebelling. They're noticing. I had another hitch where I had the high school that I went to had other witnesses. So there was a point where things got so bad that my parents were starting to know everything that I was doing at school. So at first it was little things like I wanted to do a play in drama. The play itself was about vampires. So I had the script and everything. And I told my dad about it, and he came down to the school next day and said, she's not allowed to do it. We don't deal in this kind of stuff. This is kind of a paganism. I don't want her to do it to my drama teacher. And he said, okay, fair enough. And then that day he said to me, look, if you don't do it, you're not going to get scored for this, but it's up to you. So I did it. But what I didn't know was that we were going to have people watching from other classes. And some of those people were people from my congregation. And what do you know? Someone had told their parents and they rang my parents. That's how it always was. And I felt so trapped that everything I did was known the second I got home. What the hell is the big deal?
Well, it's not like you were smoking pot in the girls' room and you got, you know, narked out by somebody. You're trying to partake in school functions.
I really want to do it, and I didn't think anyone would know. And that, I felt, was the story of my life. I thought I could always get away with just being normal, and someone would say no, you know. Because we're supposed to pull each other up. We're supposed to tell each other, you know, and watch out for each other. I felt trapped at that point, especially when my parents had allowed me to go on an overnight stay with one of my friends from school. What I didn't tell them was that it was a birthday and we're not supposed to celebrate birthdays. But it got out the following week. And that same girl found out, and my parents got a call. And that was a big enough infraction to actually bring me up against the elders. hadn't done anything up until that point which would get me into major trouble, mostly things that were just for my parents to deal with. But because I actually went to a birthday, and this was a big paganism, it was a big no-no, they felt it was their right to pull me in. And I can tell you that from that point on, I was so horrified that I had to be in this room with my parents and these three men that I was just, I never want to go back. Mm-hmm. I never want to go back. And I think that's basically when it started, the downhill, real downhill slope, where the real struggle, where I said, I can't believe this. I felt like I was being watched everywhere. And I'll have to say that this is not normal practice. You know, I think she was going rogue and she had something against me, because there were other witnesses there and they didn't care. They just, you know, went on their merry way. Mm-hmm. Why she chose to do this, I don't know, but it does happen. You'll get someone who's extremely righteous, who throws Bible passages in your face every time you see them, and reminds you, you're going to the devil.
Who was this that was going after you?
Well, it was one of the girls who was my age from my own congregation who went to my same high school.
Okay.
So I don't know what she had against me at this point, but she really did. She had something against me, and I don't think she realized the havoc that she caused by bringing in the elders and causing our family so much trouble, because we all end up splitting up not long after I left home. Her actions led to this, but what I didn't ever understand is, why didn't anybody ask her, hang on, you know, why are you always bringing us this stuff? No one ever asked, I don't think. And if you've got a kid who's tattletaling or dobbing on you, on somebody all the time, you would have to wonder why.
Well, it sounds like a typical teenage sort of jealousy rivalry kind of thing.
Yeah,
but then she,
I think so, but it would have much bigger consequences than just, you know.
It's not a tattletale on you for, you know, when you get detention in high school or you get reprimanded by your parents. This is, the church is coming down on you. The elders are going to discipline you.
Exactly. And it's terrifying, I can tell you that. They don't bring you in for nothing. It's the only time you ever with them is when you're maybe going into baptismal or doing something wrong. Yeah. So it's a very big thing. It's something you never want to have to do, and it's highly embarrassing to have to sit in front of these people and explain yourself.
And how is a teenager supposed to defend themselves against people that are such staunch religious elders that know their Bible backwards and forwards and know what's right and wrong, and you're there barely a grasp on life and you're supposed to defend yourself to these people?
I had no idea. I sat there the whole time while they quoted scripture, and they're very good people who believe in what they're doing. But just the whole impact of that very quiet talk and all the scriptures and how you, you're presenting yourself. It's this
intimidation, or
it's intimidation in the how can you say, in the best way possible, because they're not yelling at you. They're just telling you in a way that you'd be so guilty about your actions, mm-hmm, by telling you that, you know, God's not going to be pleased with this and why, and show you the scripture why. And by the end of it, you're feeling like you're going to hell pretty much, even though they don't believe in it. That's how you feel. You feel like, God, you're going to be destroyed. There's a very passive aggressive note to everything you read. Like, I think something I read recently was about letting yourself be clay in God's hand and letting him mold you. And the whole thing just felt so passive aggressive, because if you don't let God mold you, you know, become hard to him, and it's all about you. You are the reason this is not working. If you're not following the rules, it's your fault. So there's a lot of pressure on you to do right. So when something goes wrong, you know that you're going to be blamed for it and everybody else is going to be talking. The biggest lesson I had to learn was honesty on my part. I think I spent a lot of time trying to be somebody else. I think I was at school and I'd try to be somebody for my friends, and then I'd be at home, I'd be another person for my parents, and then I'd go to church. Oh, we don't call it church, but then I'd go to a meeting and then I'd feel like I'd be another person. And I thought this was absolutely normal, because when my parents would come to a meeting, sometimes they'd just been fighting and they'd come in and it's all smiles, like this whole different situation's going on, and now we're all a happy big family. And I used to sit in the congregation and think, I wonder who else, you know, what's their family really like? You know, what's that family really like? I thought that's what people did. I thought it was normal for you to adapt to every situation, just be a different person everywhere you went. So I had to really learn how to be myself and be happy with that person. Took a really, really long time.
At this point, did you decide that you no longer wanted to be there, no longer wanted to follow this?
Yeah, it was at that point where I just felt so humiliated that had been brought in front of the elders for this. I think the only thing I really did wrong in my eyes was not tell my parents about the birthday party, because then they wouldn't have let me go.
Most children, though, can go to a birthday party. I mean, if you're hanging out with friends, you're hanging out with friends, and whether or not it's a birthday party should not be that big of a factor, but...
I tried to make the argument, you know, that I didn't know. I didn't know it was going to be a birthday. It just happened. It didn't work out. But in order to do things with friends that I like, because I think that was the big problem, I didn't have anybody of my age in my congregation that I was close to. That's the reason why I was allowed some worldly friends, was because there was nobody in my congregation that I have a connection to. Were they supposed to allow me to have nobody? It's not feasible. Breaking their trust on this and me feeling like I had to do it in order just to be normal was a major turning point. I just didn't want to go anymore, and it was that whole, you know, you're living under my roof, this is the rules, this is the way it goes. And from that point on, I just don't think I listened to anything they said anymore. I felt like they'd already taken away my sport, my future, even a birthday party, they're taking away my friends. And for somebody who doesn't have a future, so to speak, there's no higher education, there's nowhere to go, it was major for, you know, a 15-year-old. I felt like I had nothing.
You were trapped.
And not only that, my father worked for the Department of Education. So he knew some of the teachers I went to school with, and anything that went wrong, he'd get a phone call. So I was trapped on all sides. There was nothing I couldn't do wrong in school that he didn't know. There was nothing I couldn't do wrong within the church that he didn't know. And I was constantly running, just getting away. I just couldn't handle it.
So did you approach your parents and explain that you no longer wanted to be in the church?
Well, I'll have to be honest, we never really had conversations. You know, it's part of these kind of religions to always be, you know, open with your children, ask them what they need, so you're always kind of on the same page. And I think part of the problem was with my own family, we didn't open up to communication. Communication, I suppose, is important in every family. I can't tell you what my parents were going through. They had their own problems. I felt like we were never a cohesive unit. Yeah. I always felt like they were my enemy. And I think my mum always felt like I was her enemy too. So I never felt well enough to say, look, I can't do this. I could never express my feelings to them because I knew it would always blow up in my face. What it was is, no, I'm not doing this. There was no conversation. It was just when we were doing doing our study for the next meeting, it would come up and I said, no, I'm not doing it. I'm not going back. And I'd lock myself in my room. My mum would then proceed to tell me that I would be doing whatever she tells me to do. And it was that kind of thing. There was no great conversation.
So when did it, I guess, come to a head? When did they figure out that you're not going to do this? Like, what was the next step in this relationship here?
During the holidays, my father thought it might be a good idea to send me away for a while. So I went to stay with my auntie, who is not Jehovah's Witness. With Jehovah's Witnesses, we're not allowed to smoke. We can drink alcohol. We don't have any dietary requirements. Everything's in moderation. And my parents didn't smoke, but everybody on my father's side of the family did. They smoke and they drank alcohol. Even all of my friends' parents smoked. I think the only people I knew that didn't were the Jehovah's Witnesses. I think we're talking about the 80s and 90s when a lot of people did. It was a really big deal. So in my mind, I always thought that these things were worldly pursuits, that these were things that worldly people did. So when I went to stay with my auntie and she would smoke in the house, I just thought, you know, this is normal. She's a worldly person. And my cousin lived with her too. And I think being able to be away from my family, and she put no pressure on me. She let me do whatever I wanted, basically, as long as I was home at a certain time. And that made me realize that over the course of, I think it might have been a month, I didn't want to go back to the way my family was and going to our religion. Mm-hmm. So when I came back home eventually, I told my parents that I can't tell you what the fight was about. We had a major fight that police were called to. And I will have to say that my mum especially was quite violent with us. It was just the way it was. And I think this was the first time I really fought back for myself. She called the police and I was kicked out that day. I didn't want to follow the rules. I didn't want to go to meetings anymore. I just wanted to do what I wanted to do. And it sounds so terrible. I think my mum thought I was just I didn't appreciate anything. And I didn't feel like I had anything to appreciate. They weren't bad people. They'd pretty much given us everything. But I felt like they used to give with one hand and take with the other. There was nothing, anything solid, because they were always worried about the choices they were making for us. And then as soon as something got too worldly, they'd pull back. And I just wanted, God, I just wanted to go. And so they
kicked you
my
out.
My mother threw me out, yeah.
What age were you when they threw you out?
I was 16 at this point. Oh, going on to 16, I think. Okay. So, yeah, I wasn't quite there yet.
Very young.
Very young. I just didn't know anything. You think you know things at that age. You just don't know. I had too much pressure to really think properly. I had not enough experience to think logically. And we often are told to believe in ourselves and believe in our hearts. And my feelings were just telling me to go. And the sad thing was is that I could never really truly express these to my parents, because it would always turn into a fight. It would always turn into an argument, because rules were rules. You know, it's not simple. It wasn't a simple enough reason to bend them for me, because this is your life, your soul at stake. And yeah. I think they were always worried about that, about allowing me to go my way while living under their roof, because it would make them look really bad towards the elders and the congregation. When they go to a meeting and someone says, oh, you know, where's the eldest daughter? And it's much easier for them to say, oh, she's gone so-and-so, than to say, oh, she's not coming to meetings anymore. I think there's a bit of shame on their part as parents that they didn't do their job. and keep us in. So it's easier for them to throw you out so they don't look so bad.
When they throw you out, do they cut off all communication with you?
They're supposed to. I wasn't excommunicated or disfellowshipped from the church. I was a young associate at this time. I hadn't been baptized yet. But I do know that someone from my school who was Jehovah's Witness said that my name had been thrown out at a congregation saying that I was no longer one, a young associate. Once you leave, there's an announcement. This person's been disfellowshipped. This person's been disassociated. Then you know you're not supposed to have contact with that person anymore. I did have contact with some of these people, but what it is just nothing beyond the hi, hello, and that's it. They're not allowed to have any more than that. They're allowed to be nice to you, but they're not allowed to inquire. So, yeah, that night my father drove me to the train station with my two little brothers in tow. He gave me $20 and said, good luck. And that was it. I got onto a train and I can't tell you the freedom that I felt. Like, okay, every decision made now was going to be mine. If I ever got in trouble with the Lord, it was my choice. I had no clue where I was going. I just ended up going to somebody's house and it was nighttime. I think it might have been about 8 or 9 o'clock by the time I got to my destination, and I just walked from the train station to my friend's house and sat on his front step and fell asleep. Because being 15 or 16, of course, all my friends are around the same age, maybe a little bit older as well, and their parents weren't going to take in a strange person. You know, you're still at this stage where, you know, you don't want your parents to really know who the girls you're talking to or the boys you're talking to. So when I went and slept on his front step and his mum found me in the morning, he wasn't very happy about that. I just had nowhere to go. Yeah. I didn't know anywhere. So his mother was very nice and, you know, provided me with some clothes, and he sent me on my way with he'll find me somewhere to stay. It ended up being with one of his friends from school who was a local gang leader of an Asian crime gang. You know, he trusted him enough and I felt like I didn't really have a choice. So I ended up staying at this house. And I remember the first thing I walked into was this small apartment with guns down the side and marijuana in massive big washing baskets. And I just thought, oh, I've walked straight from this to this. You know, it was just crazy.
That's a big culture shock for you.
It was massive shock because I think the biggest problem was that I kind of expected it because that's what the world is. The world's wicked. And I just thought that to be part of the world, that that's what had to happen, that this was going to be my choice. And when I saw the guns and I saw the marijuana, I just thought, well, I made my choice, right? This is it. This is the world. This is what you've got to do. I would say I was, you know, a little bit scared. It wasn't anything that I was used to. I had, you know, a few uncles that had guns. But apart from that, oh, I wasn't crime syndicate ready. You know, I had no idea about any of this stuff.
I don't think many people are, really.
You know, they gave me a piece on the floor to sit on while they were doing their smoking. And I just looked around and kept to myself and sat in a corner and slept there all night unmolested. No one touched me. Everything was fine until the next morning they were raided and had to jump outside of out of the balcony and run for my life, literally, because the police were after us. We were running and running and ended up in the city somewhere, and I had to have another place to stay. So they organized somebody else to look after me. And we just hung out in the city, and I went home with these guys, and he lived on a second floor apartment on top of a shop. So second story. When we got there, I obviously had no belongings. I just had myself. He told me to go take a shower, you know, get myself organized. And I only had my clothes, so I had a towel, had my shower, and the shower's a share shower with all the other apartments. So as I was coming back to his door, I just felt like something was a little bit wrong, but I didn't know what. So I just opened his door, and everyone was gone except this guy, and he was in his underwear pushing two mattresses together, and he had a knife. And I thought, what? As I closed the door behind me, I noticed the knife, and I remember the first thing I said was no. I went to turn around and open the door, and he threw the knife right at the door, and I ran to the window, and I got onto the ledge of the window, and it was at this point that I think he may have regretted his actions. I'm not quite sure, but he started saying, oh, please, don't jump. Like, it's so absurd. This guy was about to rape me 5 seconds ago, and now he's worried I'm going to jump out his window.
Yeah.
But so I'm trying to figure out what the hell I'm going to do. He's begging me not to jump out the window. He's gotten the knife outside of the door, and he's saying, I won't touch you. He put the knife down. I think what the problem was that he wasn't fearful for me, but I think he was fearful for himself. I think he thought that he could intimidate me, get what he wanted from me, and then I'd be too scared to tell anybody. I don't think he was actually going to kill me or do anything absolutely terrible where I'd lose my life, but I think he was trying to intimidate me into, you know, me sleeping with him, and then I'd be too scared to tell anybody. And when he realized that, you know, there might be a big chance that something might happen to me and somebody might know, he was going to get into a lot of trouble because he was charged for looking after me. I think when this dawned on him, he started pleading with me, oh, please don't jump, I promise I won't touch you. And I jumped. I jumped out of a two-story window, I closed my eyes, and I don't know how it happened, but I landed on my feet and ran. Ended up under a statue at the town hall. I slept under there. And I think the last thing I heard was that somebody had beaten him up for that, and I just... Rules are rules, right? Everywhere you go.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if it's religion or crime syndicates or whatever. He was set to take care of you, and he didn't, so it's weird.
Yeah, I guess from this point I was sleeping anywhere I could, and I managed to get a friend, had a car that wasn't working, and I was sleeping in his car. Just walking the streets. I had nothing to do. I had no idea what I was doing, where I was going, how to get a job, you know, even how to get food, how to get money. I had no idea. I had people coming and giving me $5 here and there just so I could buy something to eat. I was washing up in McDonald's, you know, having a sponge bath there and using the bathroom there. And I will have to say that despite it all, I really felt like I had joined the world, that this was my choice, that no matter what, I could face God and say that I did it. You know, nobody chose this for me. And I think that was really important to me and still is to this day, that I feel like if there is a God, then I want him to know I did this, that I wasn't a sheep who followed somebody else into this. So I've got no one ever in my life now, with all the actions I've done, to blame but myself. And that's exactly how I wanted it.
Wow.
So despite everything, I was really happy. I was really happy because I just didn't have the pressure. While I'm looking, trying to find food, I'm not knowing what to do with my life, I felt like there was no pressure anymore. It didn't really matter. And it's such a strange point to be in where you've got nowhere to live and then happy that you're just free?
I would assume most people would think you had a lot of pressure on you because now you're homeless on the street. So there's pressure to find food. There's pressure to get money. There's pressure to survive. Yet you felt this freedom.
I was in the world and I could go anywhere. I could do anything. There was nobody at my back. And I felt like I could leave God behind me, even though it wasn't really like that. But I thought that if I was the devil's child, then I've well and truly joined the race. And I think this whole point of good and evil, it's really confusing when everything's black and white. You know that those black and white lines often bleed into grey, and it's never the same in practicality than it is when you're reading it. And I often felt that what I was reading the Bible and what I was doing in life was just wasn't connecting. And that contradiction was a theme throughout my life, that I didn't have to worry about all of that anymore. So yeah, I was, despite it all and despite all the things that's happened, all the things that I've put myself through, really bad situations, I've woken up not knowing where the hell I was, thinking how in the hell did I get here, and not remembering anything and not knowing what was going on, but I just got up and moved on.
And it sounds like you did succeed. It sounds like you did find your way, and I'm assuming you turned out just fine. You have children, you live somewhere, you sound like you're a normal person.
Eventually it all turned out. It was a hard go because we had CES back then, which is a social worker. They're kind of a joint venture with the Social Security, except the difference is they work with youth and help you get work, help you get money, help you find a home or a place to stay. And we don't have that service anymore, but oh God, it was like godsend just to know that there was somebody or some place that I could get help and then eventually get work and then support myself, because I just had no idea of any of this. My parents both supported themselves, so I had no idea of governmental income or help by the government to get you some kind of place to live, refuges and things like that. So, yeah, I did that for a while. I think I had 3 jobs, boyfriend for a little while as well, and I've managed to have 3 kids and, we're settled here now. So it's all turned out. And
I still talk to your parents? Do you have any communication with them now?
Well, I didn't for 6 years. I think I was 21 and I had my first daughter, who's 17 now. And then I think my father always found me. How he did it, I'd never know. But every so often, every year or so, I'd hear from him and my brothers. At this point, my parents also had divorced. After I left, my parents never found a way to come together and accept it. My parents blamed each other and blamed their religion, and they ended up divorcing. And my mother still a Jehovah's Witness. A divorce is only allowed if someone leaves. So they were able to get a divorce because my father decided to leave. And he was disfellowshipped. And I think he may even be a do not call. So that's somebody you meet in field service who is a supposed apostate.
I just never get that whole cut you off and just no more contact. It just seems so unhealthy.
They're children. They're fearful of what the reprisals will be to their soul from their peers and from their governing body, whoever's in charge. I think they really do. They really are fearful of what everyone thinks of them, because gossip in these religions is massive. Everybody knows what everyone's doing, what, children are going wrong, and you don't want to be that person who's everyone's talking about. The religion, it's fear.
I have this weird
stereotype of Australia where everyone's happy and doing their thing and there's no crime or whatever there. And I realize that it's just not even remotely accurate, but it just seemed, I was like, how did you get into so much trouble after you left? Like, I didn't think it would be that prevalent.
I had a friend in 2004 who was kidnapped and killed. And I remember looking at her casket and thinking, this was a girl who was just about to finish university. She did everything right. And here she is. You know, somebody killed her. And I was thinking, this could have happened to me. When it all comes down to it, comes down to the end, all you can do is the best for your kids, the best for yourself, because in the end, it doesn't matter.
I'm just curious, but are you religious today?
I would say that I believe in the possibility. Mm-hmm. And this is another thing too. About 10 years ago, my middle child, who was 9 months at the time, had cancer. And part of cancer treatment is blood transfusions. And being a Jehovah's Witness, you're not allowed to take blood transfusions. I remember thinking while she's going through treatment that if this happened and I had married somebody within our church or within our congregation and we had a child of cancer, I wouldn't be able to do this. I would not be able to give her any treatment. I'd have to let her go. And I just couldn't imagine it. This whole concept of
disbelief in treatment, disbelief in thinking it's a sin to help, that's hard.
I just couldn't understand these parents who, like, of course they don't want to let their child die, but they felt they had to, for God's sake, that this is what he wanted, because that's what our doctrine teaches. I was just very thankful that if this was going to happen to me, to my child, I didn't have to make that decision, that despite modern medicine, it might not have worked out. She might have died, and it was a very big possibility with her because we caught the cancer quite late. So while I believe in possibilities, I understand that, you know, belief is just that. It's not necessarily real. You can believe in anything you want. It doesn't mean that it's the truth. And I think what all these religions tend to have is something that makes them stand out, that makes them have the truth. Like Jehovah's Witness, we have Bible that's the most historically correct in its truth. Mm-hmm. And I think the Mormons have their Book of Mormon, and theirs is the truth. And the Seventh-day Adventists have their own prophet and their turn of the their religion, and theirs is the truth. They all believe that they are the ones that have God's ear.
I somehow lucked out and grew up in a family that had zero religion. My grandfather apparently wasn't religious either, and my great-grandfather wasn't religious. And it's not really a rejection of religion. We just had no religion.
Yeah, and I think that's where we are in raising my children. What's happening here at the moment is that a lot of people are moving away from religion. They're not going to church as much anymore. We don't have a religion. We don't go to church. And, you know, I've tried to teach my girls to use their brain logically, to think it out and not necessarily go with everything you feel. And I think that was the big problem with me. I didn't understand that, you know, that logical thinking. You can never be punished for that by God or otherwise. You can never, ever be punished for doing your best. And I think that's all it comes down to, whether you believe or not.
Thank you. don't have to do this.
Somebody's got to do it.
Don't have to.